Welcome to Bitch Talk, booze and reviews straight from the heart of Park City, Utah. I'm Erin. That's Anne.
Hi.
You can find us at bitchtalkpodcast.com. You can also find us every Monday morning from 6 to 6:30 on BFF.fm. We are sitting at a rando hotel in Park City, Utah with someone we've wanted to have on this show for like 2 years. and we made it happen in 2020. Her name's Ruby Ibarra. Welcome to the show.
Hey, thank you both for having me. Yeah, out of all places, who would have thought it would be Utah?
It's okay.
In the middle of winter.
Right. Right. I mean, you're a busy lady, so this is a treat. So thank you so much for your time. We met you back at the Cannes Film Festival in 2018, I believe. That was 2 years ago, right? Mm-hmm. And you had a documentary there. We were really lucky to host the Q&A. But for people who don't know who you are, can you please give your origin story?
So, my name is Ruby Ibarra. I'm a rapper, first and foremost. And outside of that, I've also done spoken word, some production and music. And I've also delved in directing my own music videos, especially with this last project. And that's actually why I'll be speaking on it more later on. But that's one part of the reason why I'm here at Sundance. I do have interests in, you know, film as well, and, you know, seeing where, how else I can expand my storytelling, visiting or exploring other forms of media has always been an interest of mine, and something I've wanted to tackle. I'm a rapper from the Bay Area.
Yeah.
I've been emceeing or writing as long as I could probably, like, write out my name. But I think I really took on rapping specifically as a hobby when I was in high school. And it was a time where, you know, obviously the people that I listened to growing up, I felt didn't really reflect the life that I was living. And so it was my own way of capturing it kind of instead of you know, your standard journal format, I was writing them in raps in a notebook, like in the back of my class. And I think a lot of that, too, was due to the fact that I grew up listening to a lot of hip-hop. Mm-hmm. So my family and I migrated from the Philippines to the U.S. In the 90s. And we moved directly to the Bay Area, which has always been home for me. And I was lucky that it was the Bay Area out of all places that we ended up moving to, because as we all know, you know, it's really a community there that is so rich in culture and so rich in music as well. So I definitely grew up listening to a lot of Pac. I grew up listening to a lot of Hi-Ro. So that was, you know, my soundtrack in what I would call my formative years, like being a child and knowing who Ice Cube and Snoop Dogg was, like, you know, the West Coast rap was still booming at that time. And eventually I got introduced to artists like Wu-Tang and Lauryn Hill. Miseducation of Lauryn Hill, I tell people all the time, certainly changed, you know, my life and was absolutely vital for me as a woman of color in my teenage years and coming into my own womanhood. That was the album that really allowed me to keep my sanity and also find a voice, you know, by being a woman of color and hearing someone like Lauryn Hill just sing and rap with so much emotion and truth. I think that was the album that shifted the way I saw poetry. And that's, I think, specifically Miseducation of Lauryn Hill is the first time where I saw that, you know, music can really have an impact and you can really have a lot of substance, and it's beyond melodies, and, you know, you can really touch people's lives with your writing. So, you know, coupled with the fact that I grew up in the Bay, I had my Filipino roots, and I was raised on a lot of hip hop, both Bay Area and, you know, rappers from outside. I think all of that eventually led to me not only just writing poetry, but transitioning into recorded raps and my bedroom. I remember when I was freshman year of my high school, I was saving up my lunch money. I think for a good 4 months, I ate chips and flavored water.
I do that by choice.
It was a bad diet.
Not just by saving, yeah.
Sundance diet.
But by taste, it was good. No, but I was saving a lot of my lunch money, and eventually I saved it like $100 to be able to buy a dynamic microphone from like my local Radio Shack. And I plugged it into my computer, and that was the very first time, you know, I heard myself recorded. And just from then on, it was a lot of doing this work independently. And I've just been very grateful that I've also been able to connect with people like Beat Rock Music that have helped me to connect to bigger resources that allow me to, you know, have a more refined recording and like really find, I think, my voice and my artistry as well.
Yeah, I have way too much to respond to with that, but like I knew
right away. I was like, I'm gonna have Ange take the next one because yeah. I know
we're sharing a mic, but she handed it over to me once you started talking about who influenced you growing up, and obviously Tupac, Miseducation of Lauryn Hill, obviously integral growing up listening to. But I felt the same way. I mean, I remember Foxy Brown has one line. She says, "Now we on the rise, you down the mommy with the slanted eyes," and I was like, "What?" That was the first time I ever heard any sort of Asian reference or anything, and that was as close as I can get to relate to a female MC. And you know, Aaron and I have seen you at different shows all around the Bay, but it wasn't until you were performing at the
the Apple Store.
The Apple Store in downtown San Francisco. So it was during the day, so it was all ages. And I saw little girls in the front row rapping alongside you. They knew every word to every song. And it gives me chills. I get emotional even thinking about it, because I was like, if I saw someone that looked like me rapping the way you do with your message, like, that's so empowering, and it gives me so much hope for our future and for immigrant families that grow up seeing themselves reflected, you know, in their own heroes.
Thank
so that
you.
Was that was a really powerful moment for me, so thank you very much. But what I wanted to ask was, did you always know that your message was going to be socially conscious? Like, what, you know, because your music is not only good, I mean, the beats, the flow, but you have this message, and a lot of artists stray away from that, you know, and are afraid of that being divisive. But did you always know that you had a deeper message other than I love rapping and I want this to be my art?
So I forgot to mention earlier, the very first rap artist I ever heard in my life was actually this Filipino rapper named Francis Magalona, who was a very socially conscious rapper. I like to think that, you know, subconsciously, since that was planted in my head at an early age, that things would kind of come full circle as I started doing this more professionally, and it would happen to be the things I talked about. Like the very first song I heard was called Mga Kababayan, and it was basically talking about colorism and addressing, like, you know, we should embrace having brown skin and basically challenging the way that people think. And to be honest, at that age, at 5 years old, listening to that probably went from one ear out the other, and I just listened to the beats. But revisiting that throughout my teenage years and even until now, it's like, wow, these are the things, exactly the same things that I like to talk about and what I want to stress in my music. And I think that it was probably when I was in college and I took Asian American studies where I realized that I need, having music that speak, they're very personal in my lyrics are important, but if I'm also doing it in a way where I make people that listen to it feel seen, I think that gives it another level of not only some intimacy in it, but also I think there's a bigger purpose and message in my platform. And at the end of the day, I just want to make sure that I'm not here just to rap about nothing, because I recognize that having a platform, even as small as performing on a stage at a local school, that's still a platform. And you have, like what you mentioned, it could be little girls in the front row listening to you. And if I'm giving that platform, I should be saying something important or saying something that could help them, you know, challenge the way that they think. And especially if it allows them to see themselves, then I feel that that's my ultimate goal as an artist.
I was going to say, that's kind of the real artist though, right? Because a lot of, especially, well, I guess hip hop, all kinds of genres of music and in film, any kind of art, there are people that are sellouts and they're going to talk about things that maybe aren't relatable, but then there's people like you that talk about things that are truly relatable, especially to brown women. I wanted to get into actually why you're here at Sundance. Ange and I were really lucky to see the film A Thousand Cuts, and you were a part of that film with your music, and the backstory to that is that the filmmaker knew about you, but you both were in the Philippines at the same time. So because I follow you on social media, I knew you were in the Philippines. How was that trip? Do you go there often and perform?
So I've actually been going back to the Philippines pretty often ever since Circa 91 dropped. I've just been very blessed to be able to not only share the music out here, but bringing it back to the homeland too. And it was particularly special for me when I got to bring not only the music, but my band with me last March to really give the people their, you know, the full experience of the show. And little did we know, like one of the things that we booked was performing at Rappler's offices because they do this thing where they invite musicians over to perform live, like a set of three songs. And while I was rapping like the second verse of the last song that we were doing, you know, Maria Ressa walks in and so does Miss Ramona Diaz and the rest of their film crew. And I wasn't aware of at the time that they were filming this documentary for 1,000 Cuts, which just premiered last night here at Sundance. So that was my initial meeting with them. And then a couple months later, which was actually just last November around Thanksgiving time, Ramona and her team emailed me and they said that they were possibly interested in using the song Us for the documentary. So they were initially looking at that. And then fast forward another couple of weeks around Christmas week, Ramona brought up the idea like, hey, what if you came up with an original song?
Yeah.
For the movie. And
no pressure.
I mean, you know, I was kind of nervous. I'm like, oh wait, when's the deadline? They're like, as soon as possible. I'm like, oh yeah, sure, no problem. Like, I can skip Christmas and New Year.
Yeah, no problem. Yeah.
So, but I was totally down to do it, and I was very excited. Just knowing the impact that this documentary would have on our community and the importance of it too. Of the, you know, the things that they talk about with the war on drugs and Duterte's dictatorship that's going on right now in the Philippines, and just knowing that Maria Ressa was, you know, tied to this doc too, and she, for me, has been, for like, the definition of a resilient, strong, iconic, heroic Pinay. And I just see her, when I see her, I think of someone just absolutely fearless and using her line of work to, you know, sacrifice for freedom of speech, freedom of press. And those are things that I believe in it too. So I absolutely wanted to be part of it and support it in any way that I could. And I'm just, I don't know how this happened, but I'm humbled that they chose to have my song in the end credits of 1,000 Cuts. So if you guys have the opportunity to watch it, I would highly recommend that, you know, people watch this film. I think it's especially, it's an important piece of film that is very relevant wherever you live.
Yeah, and I think, again, I have way too many things to comment on, but, and I think at the same time, in America, you know, we're facing a similar sort of president, and we've spoken to this in our interview, but I think it kind of makes, it gives us more pride in, like, okay, we at least can speak out, and we at least, but what Maria's doing, like, they're oppressed way in the Philippines on a different level. Mm-hmm. Like, her just speaking out means her life is on the line. You know, yeah. We can walk down the street and talk about our president all we want without that fear. So that's just what makes her just even a bigger superhero. But I do want to say that Aaron and I hold you up on a pedestal too, Ruby, because you're a fighter and you're a warrior, and we love your message. And I feel like there's kind of something special that happens when you find your path, what you're meant to be doing in life, and that's why what you're doing has led you to Maria Ressa and Ramona you know, who knows where you're going to come from here. It's just like taking over the world slowly.
Yeah, thank you. Yeah.
I mean, I hope so. Like, we were sitting at that table with just such powerful women, and it's like, it just feels really good and gives us hope.
I did want to rewind a little bit to when you started performing. You're a woman of color, and I don't know if initially when you were starting to write your lyrics and to perform, you were performing in Tagalog then, but can you talk about those experiences, either negative, positively, because I think as a woman in hip-hop, it's already difficult, so if you can talk about maybe your experiences starting out and maybe up through now.
So I'll comment on using Tagalog and Filipino dialects first in music. It's always something that I've incorporated in my raps. Back when I was starting out, I actually used to do a lot of ciphers. And I was heavily involved, you know, in the underground movement in the Bay Area, underground hip hop. And I would, you know, include it in my raps because I tell people all the time, you know, Tagalog is such a percussive dialect, and it sounds so perfect when it's married with, you know, the rhymes and the beats. But it wasn't until I was writing Circa 91 where I truly found, you know, a language as a tool even. And I realized that if I'm going to be writing about immigration, if I'm going to be writing about, being a person of color, I can't have that conversation without talking about language as well.
Yep.
I know that you guys are aware of it, but growing up in the Bay Area, you know, we come from a community where you hear so many different languages, whether it's Spanish, Vietnamese, Chinese, Tagalog, it's all around us. And I felt that that was integral to be able to tell my immigrant story. You know, language is part of the culture. It's part of, it's how our ancestors told their stories, you know, through their own dialects. So for me, that's why I wanted to incorporate that in the music. And just being a woman of color in hip hop, there obviously has been a lot of challenges, I think, primarily with getting into certain doors and getting certain opportunities. You know, when we see, since it's like festival season's coming up, when we see lineups like Coachella, it's still obviously like, where's the woman on this lineup? I mean, they'll have one token woman in the lineup, but she's not, like, she won't have the big lettering and the names on the flyer. And I think that's something that we still need to challenge, especially I would say people who are gatekeepers in the industry, people who have the power to curate lineups or curate shows. I think it's our responsibility to make them diverse, make them inclusive, and make sure that, you know, we are expanding the voices that are heard.
Yeah. I don't want to hog the mic, but we had an Asian American roundtable yesterday, a filmmaker roundtable, and I had talked about gatekeeping because are you familiar with H.P. Mendoza, the filmmaker? So we had him on the podcast a few years ago too, and we had like a bottle of Jameson. It was like 2 hours of talking, but he talked about the gatekeepers, and he was like, so if we can't get through, we should be our own gatekeepers. Mm-hmm. And I feel like you're kind of a part of that new gatekeeper process. Do you feel like that's what we're doing as Asian Americans and what you're doing at this point in your life?
I was just actually at a CAMS panel before coming here.
Oh. Topical.
They also talked about gatekeepers, and one of the panelists actually said something along the lines of, I'm sorry if I'm misquoting, but she said something along the lines of, we can't make something about us if it's not by us. And I think that's an important thing to always have in the back of our heads, especially where right now in Hollywood we're seeing, you know, this rise in Asian, what people call Asian representation, but I think it's still fairly limited. We're seeing a lot more East Asian faces, and, you know, I'm celebrating, I'm 100% on that, but I feel like there's still a lot of people that need to be included in that conversation as well. And basically, I think that it is important for, if we're in the position, if us as Asian Americans are in the position to be able to bring other people who look like us into these spaces, into these, you know, certain opportunities, and we should by all means like bring each other up, because that's the only way we'll be able to get through the door, by using each other's resources. And I tell people all the time too, that's why I think that mentorship is also important, especially in the industry, and especially in the arts and music. I think that that's something that's often overlooked, but something so important and so pivotal in, you know, helping jumpstart other people's careers and just having us as a community rise together.
Yeah. So we're here at Sundance. It's only January of 2020, and I think that you probably have a big year coming up. Do you want to talk about some of your projects?
So
whatever you can talk about. How about I'll say
the
that.
The ones I can speak about.
Yes.
So I'm releasing my sophomore album. I'm hoping around summer of this year. Don't quote me on it yet.
Okay.
Until I release the official date.
Okay.
But it'll be out this year for sure. I'm also working on a couple more music videos from the last album. And like I mentioned earlier, I do have a lot of interest in filmmaking. So I also, since the inception of the album, I've always wanted to create essentially a film version of Circa 91. So I'm still in the process of writing and turning Circa 91 into more of a visual video. So like a 10 to 15 minute long adaptation of the album. So that's also in the works. And a few other writing projects that I can't speak on yet, and some other film projects that I can't speak on yet, but they'll be out soon.
Can we talk about the, are you still working like a day job? Can we talk about that a little bit?
Oh,
we don't have to say what you do, because I know it's like something in science and I don't understand.
So I don't want to bore you.
Anyways. Yeah. So, you know, Ange and I here have other jobs. I have a full-time day job, but Bitch Talk has been It's more than a passion project. It's a movement, really. And I know that you also have a day job. I don't know how. And also are this huge rising star in the hip hop scene. How do you do it? And is there a point, at some point, are you thinking of, okay, I'm just going to go, I'm going full time with hip hop and being creative?
As artists, as creatives, everyone is a hustler. I've met so many other people. I'm certainly not the only one who still has a day job that's also trying to make it in hip hop. You know, and I think it just comes with the field, like, you know, that hustle mentality. At the end of the day, I'm doing this day job to also put capital and put resources towards my music.
Yeah.
And that's helping me, you know, take it to the next level. And that's part of the reason why I've always kept my day job. But to answer your second question, I am hoping, I've told people already, actually, that I am hoping to do this full time. I'm actually engaged right now, too, so I also have a wedding.
Me too.
At the end of this year.
Me too. Yeah. If you need an officiant, I'm very affordable. Yeah.
We'll
talk after.
She's going to be my officiant for my wedding.
What?
Yeah. For real.
Bitch talk wedding.
Yeah. Scary.
Yeah, or maybe you can come to her wedding, and you can see my style. And
yeah, well, that's exciting. Congratulations.
Yeah.
Congratulations.
Yes, thank you.
Congratulations. On your wedding.
Sometimes it feels like we're married, for better or for worse, right?
But I mentioned that because my partner has been so supportive throughout all of this. And like I've had this conversation too with other people like Rocky, Faith, and Classy, and what we've all come to learn is that we're not doing this by ourselves. We're able to have these jobs and do our artistry at the same time because we have, you know, the support system around us, whether it's our partner or our family that's, you know, helping us make it on a daily basis. And my partner's been so supportive that he put me on his insurance, like the start of this year. So he's like, you can quit your job anytime, like you're covered. I'm like, oh my God, why? Like, I love you.
Right.
So, but yeah, he's been absolutely amazing. And I do plan, I think probably when I release a sophomore album, to just go in it 100%.
Yeah.
Because I can't help but think, if I've been doing this with one foot in and one foot out the door,
yeah,
I can only imagine the possibilities if I just like fully dive in.
Yeah.
And that to me excites me. And there's still so many projects that I want to take on and so many more stories that I want to tell. And I feel like the biggest challenge with having a day job and doing my artistry is finding time,
yep,
finding that balance. And there's been so many times where I've had to make the sacrifice of, or making the option of, or choosing the option, like, should I do this or should I go to work today because I don't have any more PTO hours left. And like, I turned down South By last year just because I was negative already and I couldn't take any more days off. I'm like, no, like, I'm kicking myself. So just things like that. And I don't want to be put in those positions again where I don't want to put, you know, my dreams and the things I'm passionate about on the back burner.
Yeah. I don't want to end, but we should. Ruby Ibarra, thank you so much for being on Bitch Talk. I'm so glad this happened, 2020.
Thank you both so much.
And when your new album comes out, let's have you back on and we'll talk about it.
Absolutely.
Cool. Thanks.
That was our interview with one of our favorite people in the world, Ruby Ibarra.
Finally. Patience is a virtue.
And of all times, it's like she's a local. She's a Bay Area local, and you guys get to chat with her in the middle of Sundance.
Right.
10 hours away from here. A 10-hour drive from here.
Yeah. It was perfect. And, you know, I mean, during the day, she's doing shit with DNA, and then at night, she's writing rhymes and, like, I don't know, Master of the Universe. It's totally fine.
Mm-hmm. And we got to interview her twice in one day, so that
was nice. Yeah. Duh.
I haven't had a chance to listen yet. I'm bummed I wasn't able to go, but I was pulled away. I was pulled elsewhere.
Per the huge, we just had to go different. We had to go our separate ways. Is that a song? But I do want to mention that when we interviewed Ruby, we only learned an hour or two before that Kobe Bryant had passed away.
Mm-hmm.
And it was one of those things where it was a lot to handle in a very short amount of time, especially Ange was a huge, huge, huge Kobe fan. Huge, huge. And she found out before any of us. We were in a Lyft lounge and she just started saying, oh my God, oh my God, oh my God, before anyone else in that room knew. And so
we went, friends in LA.
Yeah,
we're on top of it.
Yeah. We went from that to interviewing Ruby and had no idea until after the interview. And because we didn't even talk about it before, we just didn't think about even bringing it up because we've been wanting Ruby on the mic forever.
Well, yeah, I didn't want to take time out of her interview because we have so much to say to her.
Right.
But I also, you know, she's from the Bay and everybody in the Bay hates LA teams and LA for that matter. So I was just like, oh, I'm not going to. Also, she might not even be a Laker fan, so whatever.
And then we find out.
Yeah. And then right after the interview, she's like, did you guys hear that Kobe died?
Yeah.
And she was all upset about it. She was a big fan, too. So.
Yeah. You guys had a moment, which was nice. But
we had lots of moments.
Yeah.
I was just like, yeah.
I think there, Ange was looking at Ruby like how she looked at one of the directors from Bloody Nose, Empty Pockets, which you'll hear at some point
soon.
That
was a different look. No, but
still lovingly.
But it is true that kind of halfway through the Ruby interview, I think it was real overwhelmed. One, because of the Kobe thing, but also because she's just so dope. I just kind of stopped asking questions.
So I was just like, okay.
I just wanted to listen. And then I just, Aaron, thankfully, you had an abundance of questions. But I just kind of like stopped after a while and just enjoyed listening to her talk.
Yeah, she's amazing.
Well, our amazing social media producer, Shoshana, didn't know much about Ruby at all. And that was the first thing she came to me. I was like, so how'd that interview go? And she was like, oh, it was completely inspiring. She was so into it. And she was so glad that she was able to be there for it and stuff. So that's cool.
Shoshana's going to start listening now.
Yeah. She's going to be the number one fan.
Yeah. You're going to have a tall white girl in our way in the concerts.
Well, she'll have
blocking
to stand
my
back.
View.
She needs to stand in back. But we hope you enjoyed Ruby's interview. If you don't know her, check her out. She's a force.
She's so smart.
Yeah.
And thoughtful and...
She's another one where you're just sitting there like, dang.
She was, and we'll hear more from her too from one of our other interviews on the Festival Daily Buzz.
Yeah, the reason why she was at Sundance was she has a song and a documentary called 1,000 Cuts, which Ange and I really enjoyed. It kind of harkened back to another interview I did a few months ago about the film The Kingmaker, where it's really involved with the presidency, well, the rise of Duterte. I want to say Duarte. Duterte. It was really interesting. It's 2 hours of really great footage and a great story. But so Ruby has a song in that. And then we had our own personal Ruby interview.
Right. Yeah. So we got to have her for 10 minutes with Ramona. And then after that,
the director
of 1,000 Cuts, which you'll hear on a later date. And then you guys, that same day, 3 hours later, you guys were sitting.
23-24 minute interview with Ruby Ibarra, which was awesome. So we hope you enjoyed that. In the meantime, you can find us at bitchtalkpodcast.com. You can also find us every Monday morning from 6 to 6:30 on BFF.fm. We are powered by GoTo Productions.
Bitch, please. Oh, you like the quiet boy?